From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the future, we'll be able to talk to computers instead of typing onto a keyboard, and we'll carry around our complete medical history on a software module. On today's Fresh Air, how the new world of information will change our lives, we talk with Michael Dertouzis, director of MIT's Laboratory for Computer Science. He's written a new book called What Will Be. And speaking of computer technology, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he was a dummy about CD-ROM until he listened to a CD-ROM called Classics for Dummies. Now he's a fan, and he has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. Embassy in Honduras says a U.S. military plane crashed on the street in Tegucigalpa today. It was trying to land at the airport. Two people were killed and four others were hurt. Air traffic controllers say the C-130 transport plane had taken off from Panama. The plane crashed north of the city runway, blocking traffic around a normally busy overpass. The plane took down power lines as it came down, cutting electrical power to much of the southern part of the Honduran capital. Jury selection continues today in the Oklahoma City bombing trial. The judge is taking extraordinary measures to hide the identities of potential jurors. From Denver, NPR's Mark Roberts reports.
Courtroom spectators can only get a glimpse of prospective jurors when they arrive through a door leading to the jury box. Once they're seated, a partition blocks the view to all but the judge and the lawyers. Each one is introduced with a number, as say juror 851, to keep their names confidential. The questionnaire each juror was asked to fill out has also been kept secret. After they're sworn in, the judge and the attorneys ask how much they know about the case and if they can give bomb suspect Timothy McVeigh a fair hearing based on the evidence. Judge Mache also asks each one if he or she thinks the death penalty is justified and under what circumstances. Timothy McVeigh, dressed in khaki pants and blue long-sleeved shirt, would sometimes laugh and joke with his lawyers, but look much more serious when questions focused on the death penalty. I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
President Clinton is going to ask the Federal Communications Commission to look into the possibility of curbing liquor advertisements on television. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Later today, the president will act against the liquor industry's decision to end its 50-year-old voluntary ban against advertising on television. The president will ask the Federal Communications Commission to study the liquor industry's decision to see if liquor ads should be curbed or banned outright. The president will not call for such a ban himself. The move follows several politically popular steps the president has taken to curb or ban advertising for tobacco. The liquor industry is already criticizing the president's plans. The Distilled Spirits Council of the United States says the president is not cracking down on beer ads, which are prevalent on television. President Clinton has made his view on liquor advertising known. During the campaign, he asked the liquor companies to uphold their voluntary ban, saying without it, the job of being a parent becomes even harder. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Defense lawyers for a former drill instructor have lost their effort to interview high-ranking Army officials about his case. Sergeant Delmar Simpson's charged with 25 counts of rape. His lawyers wanted to interview Army officials who've previously called for zero tolerance of sexual misconduct. They say those comments make it impossible for Simpson to get a fair trial. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 5 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher today for the first time in three turbulent sessions. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market is rebounding from 2 days of weakness that cut 4% from the Dow. Today's advance is being led by consumer stocks. These are referred to as defensive issues because their profits are typically more consistent during periods of slower economic growth. It's a strategy being used at a time when investors are betting the Fed will raise interest rates further to reduce the economy's growth rate. Today's economic news was unexpectedly strong, arguing in favor of a rate increase. Nationwide manufacturing expanded at its fastest pace in 2 years during March, and construction spending posted its strongest increase in a year during February. I'm Doug Krisner.
A private business research group says the economy will likely maintain its robust expansion. The Conference Board reports its index of leading economic indicators rose a stronger than expected 0.5% in February. The index is designed to predict economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. A consumer group says people are paying more to use automatic teller machines. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group says the number of ATMs that charged other banks' customers a surcharge grew by 45% during the last 6 months. The group survey also finds the average cost of the surcharges are up, with big banks charging more than small ones. Connecticut and Iowa have outlawed these surcharges, and a dozen other states are considering similar legislation. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 5 points at 6,588. The Nasdaq is down 2 points at 1,219. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can get a good sense of where computer technology is headed and how it developed in the past by looking at the MIT Lab for Computer Science. The lab brought us time-shared computers, spreadsheets, the Ethernet, and RSA encryption. It's also the home of the World Wide Web Consortium, which develops standards for the web. My guest, Michael Dertouzos, has been the head of the lab since 1974. In his new book, What Will Be, he looks at technology currently being developed in the lab and how it might change our lives. He also tries to separate the realities of technology from the futurist hype. I asked him first about the function of the World Wide Web Consortium based at the lab.
Well, this is a place where 160 companies from around the world sit around the table with us. And these are companies interested in how the web will progress. And the web, as you know, is a standard. It's a set of protocols, agreements of how to do security, how to do payment, and so on. And it evolves. It's not stationary. So the consortium is responsible for setting the directions for the World Wide Web. If you wish, it sets the standard.
So tell me what issues you're working on now with the consortium.
Right now, we're working on trying to, you know, the pornography issues and the concern. Yeah, we've established an approach at the lab, which we call PICS, P-I-C-S. And that lets parents choose a third party that would rate the various sites on the web. For example, you might choose the PTA of your neighborhood, or you might choose the Catholic Church, or the vendor of the maker of the movies that you're watching, or what have you. It's up to you what you want to choose. And what we're doing is putting in the standard the ability to latch your browser on this third-party rating. So if you want your child not to watch things that rater doesn't like, you latch your browser to the rater, and from then on, your child can only access the sites that are rated okay for that child's age. Sort of a uniform way of spreading the rating, the parents, without relying always on one source like the government or an association, a single association.
I imagine it's very important to you to make sure that the web is free of censorship.
Absolutely, absolutely. We want the web to be as free as possible. On the other hand, we realize that it crosses national cultures and throughout the world, and it has taken, in some cases, thousands of years to build these cultures, so we have to be sensitive to that, too. And I worry about this a lot in my book.
What are some of your concerns about government regulation of the web?
I really am not that concerned about government regulation of the web. I think some governments will try, and we're seeing the beginnings of that in some of the Asian countries. I think we've seen in France a little bit of activity. They're concerned about U.S. culture penetrating them too much. And I think these are the sort of concerns I have. I do not have any concerns or fears about Big Brother, because that just isn't in the cards. It can't play in this medium.
You write in your book that the web and the Internet are really a long way from being a true information infrastructure. In what ways are they not quite up to what they could be?
Right. Well, the simple way I describe this future to which we're all headed is that it's like a village marketplace where instead of the people buying and selling physical goods, the computers and the people, and I'm talking about 500 million of them, Terry, by the year 2007. So all these interconnected computers and people will be buying, selling, and freely exchanging information and the work which massages information. So that is the model toward which we're headed. Now, I ask you, can we do these things today? And partly we can, but we're still a very, very long way off. For example, we do not yet have the ability to buy freely on this medium. We're still a little concerned about privacy, about security issues. So that has to be put in place. Second, when we communicate with others, we ought to be sure that our communications will be private. When we receive a message from somebody, we ought to be sure it is from somebody rather than from an imposter. More important, we want to be able to have on this medium the ability to work with other people. Now, this notion of group work, of working with other people at a distance, is terribly important and could really change the nature of our economy and our work and our lives, actually. All that is software yet to be developed. Going beyond that, you know, today's email is basically text and things you type. We need to be able to communicate with our machines in a more natural way by speaking to them and by hearing from them spoken words again. Go ahead.
Well, that's one of the things your lab is working on.
Absolutely. And other places around the world, too.
It's actually pretty amazing to me that there can be a speech interface on a computer and that computers can translate speech to text and text to speech. But what are some of the biggest obstacles to doing that researchers in your lab are confronting now?
Well, first of all, if you come to my lab, you will see speech understanding programs working today where you can sit in front of them and casually speak to them, and they'll understand 90% of the sentences you utter. So this is not futures. This is happening. It costs a lot of money today, $15,000, $20,000 in the equipment. But in 5 years or so, this could be down to $200, $300. So the first point I want to make is that it's much more real than we think.
Mm-hmm.
The problems that we're facing, if you wish, at the technical level, there is really only one big problem. And that is you cannot have a discussion over an unlimited set of topics. You can't have a discussion on philosophy or politics or, you know, wide-ranging things that require common sense. We cannot give you the 90% understanding there. It drops to about half of your sentences.
Is that because the words are too difficult or the concepts are too...
No, it's because when we understand speech, we don't really understand only words. We understand concepts and we use our intelligence. So computers don't have that much intelligence. And if we narrow the topic of discussion, say we're booking tickets from an airline, it's pretty standard. It knows what to expect from you. Expect a ticket. You're going to ask a question from where to where. What time does it fly? What kind of food do they serve? And so on. So maybe there are 30, 40 categories of questions. And you may ask them in a million different ways, but it knows where to put them in what slot. And that's what makes it difficult, if it doesn't have a slot to put what you ask.
Is there a scientific way of breaking down the components of speech into bytes that scientists have come up with?
Well, yes, there is, and they're called phonemes, and they're the smallest fragments of spoken sounds, things like ah, o, and f, and g. And linguists and audiologists and phonologists put together sound out of these phonemes. But the computer has trouble telling where a phoneme starts and where another one stops. You know, if you're a native speaker and you want to say gas shortage, why don't you say it?
Gas shortage.
Say it fast.
Gas shortage.
See?
Gas shortage.
You crunched the S and the SH into one sound. Now, I'm European born, and I cannot do that. I keep saying gas shortage. Even if I say it fast, it's two sounds. So there are a lot of variations like this, how you accent your words, mm-hmm. whether you cough in between. And a computer has a heck of a time finding where one word stops and another starts. So it's got to test it against some categories.
So do you have to program 1,000 different variations of gas shortage before the computer can recognize me saying it and you saying it?
That would be too much. No, we have about 80 features which characterize some of the important ways in which speech is detected. And then we have a huge dictionary which lists the various ways of pronouncing things like Harvard or Harvard or Harvard. And we stitch in between those extremes and we can have the machine understand.
Will the computer ever speak back to us and sound like a real person as opposed to the kind of computer voices that we hear now?
First of all, it's speaking back to us already. But as you say, the sound is a little bit on the funny side. Yes, there is a lot of work on that, and it's a lot simpler problem than understanding what you say. But look forward to future work that will stitch together speech from a human being, words stored away, fragments stored away, to make a more intelligible sounds and speech.
Will the more developed this type of vocal interface becomes, the less we'll have to rely on typing to communicate through the
Precisely.
Internet. What are some of the uses that you see of a speech interface?
Sure. I think communicating with your programs, for example, if you want to have a trip, you turn to your computer and you say, take me to Philadelphia tomorrow around 10 a.m. Now that took you, you know, maybe 7 or 8 seconds to say. Now, your machine could comprehend it, turn around, and then stream a bunch of commands to the airline computer, and then get back the answers, negotiate. Maybe there's no flight at 10, maybe 10:30. And, you know, 10 minutes later, with the machines offloading the work from you, you can have your job done. That's a great winning in efficiency and in saving your time. You could use voice to shop. You want to shop from a store in Paris or in England or in Japan, you should be able to speak to the catalog, look at it perhaps. So there is another use. Then there are a lot of uses in the intersection of telephone and video screens. You know today how exasperated we all get by hearing the phone operators, the automated ones,
mm-hmm.
saying if you want marketing, press 1, if you want engineering, press 2, you know.
Yep.
You might see all of these departments on your screen at once, and then you might speak the one you want. It might save you time and aggravation not having to listen to all of them. So there are literally countless uses for speech, but think more of dialogue, you speaking to your computer, rather than what most people tend to think, which is transcription, just sitting and speaking long, long sentences and then having the computer type them out. This is not what the uses will be. They'll be more like dialogue. You know, get me this, get me that, do you have this, do you have that, and so on.
Michael Dertouzos is my guest, and he's director of the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science and author of the new book, What Will Be? How the New World of Information Will Change Our Lives. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Dertouzos, director of the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science and author of the new book, What Will Be? One of the most popular uses now of the internet is email. And years ago, you swore you wouldn't use email anymore. Mm-hmm. What was so frustrating to you about email?
Well, you know, we were lucky. I mean, we had computers in our homes in the 1960s. And we had huge terminals, and we had email in our classes. In early 70, I had a class of about 300 students. And whenever the lectures went well, all was peaceful and quiet. But whenever I blew it in one way or another, I would get back 300 messages. And that's when it dawned on me that this wide open door might also be a door to a lot of trouble, because I had to answer every one of these messages and pay attention to it. So I started discouraging the use of email, but of course I kept reading it. Most people will turn around and say, well, Michael, you know, maybe you had 300 students, but all I need is to talk to my buddy and my sister and my brother and so on. All right, but what are you going to do if 1,200 telemarketers hit you in one day through email? How are you going to tell them apart? And you know, people are clever. You cannot tell a telemarketer from a friend. So I think this notion of being able to streamline our mail systems in the future is a very important one.
Are there filtering systems that are being developed now?
Yes, there are, but as you would imagine, they're either fairly simple schemes where you say, I want to hear from Michael, but not from Jane, and it blocks Jane. Or perhaps they search for words and to see if certain keywords that are important to you are mentioned. We designed such a filter years ago, and people got irate because they got rejected by a mere computer after spending valuable human time to compose their messages. So there are a lot of social issues here in addition to the technical ones in rejecting or filtering email.
So after swearing that you wouldn't use email anymore, do you actually still use it?
I refuse to answer on the grounds. you know, I do get already, as it is, about 100 messages a day, so I do look at some of it. Actually, it's very important to look at email if you want to sense the pulse of your organization. And the art of it is to be able to look at the things that are important and to, with your various people that help you, to be able to handle the rest of them. So that's a difficult thing. I was with a few chief executives the other day, and they're facing exactly the same problem. They spend at least an hour a day looking at their email if they're live and involved in their companies.
You've consulted to Vice President Al Gore on the national information infrastructure. Where are we now?
Well, If you ask the question from a national perspective or a political perspective, it's hard to separate it from the overall thing. So let me comment on the whole thing. The fact that there are 40 million users of the web and the internet, I think, gives you a pretty good idea of where we are. There are 7 billion people in this world. Only 10% of them have telephones. That's 700 million people. And if you take 10% of those, then you're to 70 million. And we're not yet up there. We're about half that. So we're about at half of 1% of the world with respect to the web. That's about as good a picture as I can give you. It's still very small.
And what's the state of how interconnected we are as compared to how interconnected we might be?
Well, we are very nicely interconnected over long distances and long haul. For example, in the United States and the developed world, the industrial world. But we're a little bit wanting as we get close to our homes and offices. We still have wires going from our homes to the phone exchanges, and we have coax cables in some parts of the world, like America and Belgium. But in other parts, there is no video cable. And even when you go to the developing world, they don't have long-haul lines either. So the state of connectedness is very variable. It's very dense in the rich world. It's, in fact, almost directly proportional to wealth. It's wanting and lacking as you get close to the homes because it's designed for telephony. And it's not capable yet of carrying the video and all those exciting things that we talk about.
You know, it's really paradoxical to me. I thought that satellites were supposed to liberate us from wires. And now everything seems to be wires again. Not everything, but I mean, you know, cable is wires and computers are wires.
Yeah. The reason for that is, of course, that satellites are very expensive, Terry. It costs $300 to $400 million to shoot one of the geosynchronous birds, you know, the ones that stand over our heads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of money. And then when you're up there and when the satellite is up there, it can only handle so many people. So when you do all your arithmetic, it turns out that wires are still very inexpensive. But there is a lot of satellite activity underway. I should say that by 2003, There will be up there a lot of new birds. And there are some companies aspiring to connect 50, 100 million people that way with little dishes, you know, on the side of your house. Certainly with satellites, you can reach the remotest parts of the world. And for the developing world, it's maybe the only way to do it fast and inexpensively.
I think there's a lot of different corporate interests that would like to control the wires that computer information passes through. Do you think that there's going to be a big commercial war over who gets to control the information infrastructure?
The wars are already underway for controlling the market share, if you wish. It's economic wars.
Yeah, who are the players?
Well, some of the big players here are, of course, the carriers of telephony in the U.S. That would be the Baby Bell companies, AT&T certainly, you know, all the companies that busted out of AT&T when it was split up. And in the rest of the world, it is the what are called the PTT, the Post Telephone and Telegraph Companies, which are usually national large organizations. And then, of course, you have the television companies and the cable companies in the U.S. And you have content, people who own movies, the Murdoch type of companies, Bertelsmann in Europe, and so on. And then you have a whole bunch of other people who would like to play in the game. So there are a lot of players, and that's maybe part of the answer to you, that you need not worry that some single force is going to control all of these wires and wireless links. There is a lot there and a lot of opportunity, and no single force can do it. In fact, my own forecast is that there will be both telephonic and video, and in addition to those, the video cable and the telephonic, there will also be satellites and perhaps even some surprise contenders from your gas company and your electric company that own some real estate near every house.
Michael Dertouzos directs the MIT Lab for Computer Science. His new book is called What Will Be. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear about the Guardian Angel, computer software currently under development that tracks your medical history from birth to death. We continue our talk with Michael Dertouzos, director of MIT's Laboratory for Computer Science. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the CD-ROM Classical Music for Dummies.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Dertouzos. He's directed the MIT Lab for Computer Science since 1974. In his new book, What Will Be, he examines some of the new computer technology under development in the lab and how it may change our lives. The MIT Laboratory for Computer Science is working on a lot of new uses of interconnectivity. You're working on something called Guardian that might help us in healthcare. Would you explain what that is?
Imagine, if you will, a piece of software that you acquire when you are born and that accompanies you throughout your entire life until you die. Now, this piece of software resides in part on a little personal device that you carry with you, in part in your home computers. So it's sitting in around two or three different places. But what it does is, at minimum, it tries to keep a record of your medical activities. You know, did we get an x-ray ordered? Yes. Was that x-ray taken? Yes. Was it read? Yes. Were there drugs prescribed? Yes, and so on. So it can keep a track of your medical history throughout life, and that enough and by itself is very important, because as you move from one place of the world to another, there is this one thing that cares about you, your guardian angel that keeps records about you. But it gets a lot more exciting next stage when it can do verifications. It can check, for example, a doctor is about to administer a drug, and either he or you might check, and a guardian angel says, halt, stop. We've had a kidney ailment when we were 12 years old, and we're worried about whether the kidney can absorb this. So it could act in that capacity. And then, of course, the most exciting thing you could do with it is forecasting. Look at you or me and say, based on what I see so far and the patterns you've reported, you're heading for a pretty bad arthritis in about 10 years. So the guardian angel is an exciting idea of a software that helps you take care of your own health. And oddly enough, you can apply it to other things besides yourself. For example, your car. It could acquire a piece of software when it's born and carry it with it until it dies.
Yeah, and for those of us who tend to lose things like this and be very forgetful, this type of thing could be very handy. What is BodyNet that's being developed at your lab?
Well, BodyNet is a realization, of course, that you could carry a lot of electronic devices on your body. You've seen people who carry their little radio, the Walkman, a little video Walkman. They carry an LCD diary. They carry a pager. They carry a portable telephone, and on and on and on. All these things share the same displays. They share the same keyboards, but they're all duplicated. You know, I've seen people reading from their LCD diary and transferring it to their cellular phone, you know. So why not bunch all these things together so that they can talk to each other? And the idea of the BodyNet is it's a little network. It's made out of radio waves, so it envelopes your body. It's low enough power so it doesn't hurt you. And then as you buy different pieces of electronic gadgetry, you just put them in your pocket or strap them on your belt. So, you know, your little computer becomes a matchbox. Your cellular phone becomes another matchbox. And your TV becomes another one. Then you wear glasses where each eye can see what the computer projects to it. And these glasses have microphones and earphones. We can even read how you're moving your eyes, right or left. And now here you are walking down the street, with this marvelous contraption on you, and your phone rings, except it doesn't ring. You see a flash, maybe. So you jerk your eyeballs to the right, which says, I'll answer. And then you hear the person, you speak to them. Or you jerk your eyeballs to the left, and a sweet voice says, my master is not responding. And of course, you can do a lot more. You pick up a camera, want to take a picture, bring it close to your body net, and you tell your camera to take the clearest picture rather than the fastest picture. And on and on and on. So it's a way of really letting all the devices on your body talk to each other conveniently for your benefit.
Now, the glasses that you would see the displays on, you'd be able to see where you're walking with those glasses too?
Yeah, these would be superimposing on, this is what's called augmented reality. So you see through them, and you also see projected images on them. And if it gets too bothersome, then you can just sit down. But, you know, pilots do this today. They see the heads-up displays they have. They see outside their plane, and they also see their instruments projected on their screen in front of them.
How far developed is this?
Well, there have been various experiments. We built some prototypes, and it's the kind of thing where the technology is here. There is absolutely nothing in the technology that is new. The biggest problem, as always is the case in this new world of information, is securing human agreements. You've got to get all these companies that manufacture little radios and LCD diaries and cellular phones and all that to produce them so they can speak to a body net. And they won't do it until there are enough body nets around and you get into a vicious circle.
My guest is Michael Dertouzis, author of What Will Be, How the New World of Information Will Change Our Lives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Dertouzis, director of the MIT Lab for Computer Science. You're thinking about the possibilities of a world library. Now, in the way we already have that through the web, which is a library of all kinds of good stuff and a lot of what you describe as info junk. But what kind of world library are you envisioning?
Oh, I have great dreams about that. I imagine every country of the world and organizations as well as national archivists and other people in these countries, putting their wares on display, so to speak, whether they are the current folklore, the current songs, or, as in the case of my native Greece, artifacts from 3,000 years ago, whether they're statues or monuments or music or books or dresses or what have you. I envision all those goods being there. And then I can imagine you or me or a 12-year-old child anywhere in the world jumping in the little in a little virtual copter. I call it the historicopter. Actually, they're sitting in front of their machine, and they play with a joystick, and if they go forward or backward or right or left, they move on the Earth's surface very fast. They can go from Greece to China in no time. But if they dive, they go backwards in time. So they could go back to, say, 400 B.C., and if they're in Greece, they might be looking at some of the books by Plato and questions, you know, do you become a politician sort of by heredity, or do you acquire it by learning it, which was a favorite question of those days. And then they jerk the joystick left and they find themselves in China, and they see what Confucius was saying about obeying your father and your mother. And then they jump up to the Renaissance and go to France or Italy. I mean, it could be a wonderful way to learn. And as you approach a building, if it's colored red, you know, it has books in it. If it's colored blue, it has maybe statues. And if it's colored green, it has music in it, and on and on. I think the wealth of the world's heritage could become available to all of us, and it would be a marvelous thing to have, and it probably would happen over the web.
Tell us about something else that you're excited about that your lab is working on now.
Well, we are developing new operating systems, or new facades, as I like to call them. You know, today when you speak to your computer, when you turn it on, you see Windows or you see Mac. But all those things were devised years ago, decades ago, really. They're the same old system, slightly improved, from a time when we had only a single computer. Those times are gone. We're now seeing millions of computers belonging to other people. So we need new facades. We need new ways to interact with these machines. And it's these kinds of systems that we're developing today, and I'm very excited about them.
Explain a little bit more what these systems are.
These are systems that let you progress easily without encountering steep slopes of learning. For example, you might just go on and drag from a box where you see stock prices. Just drag the stocks and the stock prices you're interested in and put them in another box, which is now your box. And from then on, you're monitoring these stock prices, whatever they may happen to do. Now, if you can do this today, of course, easily if you have the program to do it. But I'm talking about grabbing these prices and these individual little tidbits of information from all over the world. You just go to a London computer and you see something you like and you just drag it from that box to your box. And from then on, it's updated and it shows you what you want to see. So a way of walking around the world and collecting information. Another thing that's very exciting in this area is being able to automate what computers do with each other. You know, Terry, we get so excited by the web and the email. And in a sense, these things are still very, very taxing of our own brain. Let me, if I may, take you back to the industrial age. We were shoveling with our shovels, and then came the bulldozers, and we dropped our shovels, went on the bulldozers, and started really moving earth and making progress. Well, before the computer, we're sitting around writing and typing, and now the computer comes, and guess what? We're still writing and typing, and we're still using our brain 100% of the time, and our eyes 100% of the time. So in some sense, people have given us these diamond-studded high-tech shovels, and they've said, keep shoveling, and we're shoveling. So one of the exciting things we're working on is to throw the shovels away and to automate the things that people do with each other by having computers do them with each other, low-level brain work, clerical work, things that take today a tremendous amount of time and lots of people to do.
What does the problems that AOL is having, America Online, with the network crashing say to you about the current limits of interconnectivity?
Well, those are growing pains. All these delays and bottlenecks will go away, and in fact, probably faster than most people think. These are not the big problems of tomorrow. They're caused because the current system is incapable of coping with things beyond the telephone. I mean, it was designed for a 3 to 5 minute telephone conversation, and people now log in and stay on for 2 hours, and that's part of the problem. But clever people throughout the United States and the world are upgrading the lines and improving this so that those problems will go away in 2, 3, 4 years. Other problems will emerge, but these are not the ones that worry me.
And which ones do worry you?
Well, I talk about a lot of them in What Will Be, but one of the problems that worries me is the gap between the rich and the poor. You see, computers have a way of helping you if you already have physical goods and if you already have physical services and a certain degree of wealth. Then computers can be useful to you to do what you're doing faster, better. And in doing so, you get even better and even more productive and even richer. Whereas if you're poor, you really don't have much use for computers because you don't have goods or wealth to improve or to make better with these computers. If you look at the numbers, it's staggering. In the U.S., we spend 10% of our economy on computers and software and the salaries of people who work with that. And if you look at Bangladesh, for the same number, they spend less than 0.1%, less than 100 times as much per person or per capita than we do. So the rich have great use for computers, whether they're people or whether they're countries, and with them they get richer and the poor don't. And left to its own devices, I'm worried that this gap may just grow.
Michael Dertouzos is my guest, and for over 20 years he's directed the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science. How did the laboratory get started, and what was your mission at the very beginning?
Well, we are sort of the post-Sputnik era, you know. When Sputnik came up in 57, America felt that it was losing the technical battle. So the Department of Defense founded an agency called ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency. And they, in turn, had an information office or a computer office. And in those days, the computers were just used to calculate how to fire a bullet or a gun. Nobody envisioned what we're doing with them today. But there were people there who were visionary and did have that vision. And they said, that could make a big difference in the world. Why don't we put a lot of money behind very few good places and see what happens? And they chose three places, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, and thankfully for me, MIT. And they gave a lot of good money to the researchers. And I think if you go back and look at the history, you can trace America's dominance in the computer business largely to this early investment.
And what specifically were you trying to come up with in your lab in the beginning?
In our lab, as in the other two universities, we were trying to make computers time-shared, which means accessible by a lot of different people, same machine, so you could share its cost. And the second thing we were doing is trying to make the machines more intelligent, so they could emulate human intelligence, understand what we were telling them, and so on. These were the basic goals back in the early 60s.
The Internet was, before it was called the Internet, was a Defense Department project.
Right.
And I'm wondering...
It was called the ARPANET.
And you were participating in that very early
Absolutely. Version
of the Internet.
Yes.
In those early days when the money was largely coming from the Defense Department, were they open to the kind of creative thinking and even mayhem that computer experts and wizard students were bringing to it?
The answer is yes and no. Under the covers, they were all open to it. They realized that this is what was giving the nation a tremendous impetus forward. So they really let us have a lot of latitude. But, of course, in formal surroundings, they couldn't always do that. So I remember, you know, there were a lot of these crazy things happening, like wine lists. People would accumulate on these expensive machines that the Department of Defense paid for, lists of wines or lists of restaurants and ratings, things that you see today on the Internet. Now imagine them, you know, 25 years ago. And some general would see that and would get very upset and say, we're going to chop all the funding to that agency if you don't take those wine lists away. But these were really sort of little things. People understood at all levels that this was important, and they encouraged it. And actually, they still do.
What are you most looking forward to in the future?
Well, I'm looking most to... let me start by telling you that it's been an incredible high. For 30 years now, I've been just waiting for the shoe to drop, for this honeymoon to end, and it hasn't. It keeps getting better. So now I'm conditioned to it. I'm looking for more. I'm looking for a time when this information marketplace will spread throughout the world, when it will not be only the province of the wealthy industrial nations. I'm looking forward to the 90% of the world who don't have telephones today, to eventually get their voices heard. I'm looking forward to a world where much more learning can take place and where this movement, the great information revolution, can take its place right next to the agrarian and the industrial one as the third major socioeconomic movement in our history.
Well, Michael Dertouzos, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right.
Michael Dertouzos is the author of What Will Be and the director of the MIT Lab for Computer Science. Coming up, the CD-ROM series Classics for Dummies. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's always resisted new technology, but once his resistance breaks down, he becomes captivated by it. A new series of CD-ROMs, Classics for Dummies, seems to have been made with people like him in mind.
My mother was the first person in her neighborhood to get a telephone, a radio, and a car. But I didn't follow so easily in her adventurous footsteps. I was once convinced that computers meant the end of good writing. Now I couldn't live without one. Same with email. When was it I was sneering at CD-ROMs? Who needs pictures to listen to music? What does it mean to listen interactively? And frankly, given my track record, I was nervous just about the process of installing the discs on my computer. But I'm head over heels over EMI's series of Classics for Dummies. The installation turned out to be pretty simple, and though you can treat these CD-ROMs as ordinary compact discs and just listen to them, the interactive stuff is great fun. You can read a fairly snappy biography of each composer. You can click on certain outlined words and see pictures of parents, hometown, or a famous concert hall. You can read a detailed but comprehensible second-by-second play-by-play of what you're listening to as the seconds tick off in a corner of the screen. And each disc has one short piece during which you can look at a score and actually choose which instrument you want to hear. You can even play conductor and change the tempo. Eventually, you'll even be able to change the instrumentation. This Classics for Dummies series derives from the best-selling books that explain in ordinary language such esoteric subjects as the internet, personal finance, golf, and wine. Each of the 24 CD-ROMs so far is devoted to a single composer, and the information is helpful, though there are some factual errors and typos which I'm told are being corrected. Some of the writing is a little condescending. Does anyone really need to be warned, and I quote from the Beethoven disc, not to slip in a T into the title of the Third Symphony, that it's eroica, not erotica? But I haven't found much of that lowest common denominator. There's about an hour of music on each disc, so we get only single movements or short pieces. The Wagner disc includes only overtures and brief orchestral selections. But the choices are astute. Most of the performers from the rich catalog of Angel Records are pretty classy. Violinists Nathan Milstein and Joseph Suk, pianists Claudio Arrau and Annie Fischer. Carlo Maria Giulini conducts Beethoven and Verdi. Simon Rattle conducts Prokofiev and Stravinsky. Klaus Tennstedt conducts Mahler. If we don't get the complete Mozart clarinet concerto, at least we get the sublime slow movement, and in my favorite performance, by Jack Brimer with Sir Thomas Beecham and the Royal Philharmonic. Not every performance in the series has this special vitality, and the choice of composers is pretty conservative. There are none born in this century, and no women. EMI is donating entire sets of these CD-ROMs, along with some seed money, to a national organization of music teachers to help get classical music back into the schools. That might be just what it takes to get a new generation interested. And the marketers at EMI are no dummies.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new CD-ROM series Classics for Dummies on EMI. They can also be played as CDs. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.